Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonjour et bienvenue à tous pour cette troisième conférence de notre collègue, la professeure Shimazu Naoko du Tokyo College, qui fait partie donc de l'Université de Tokyo. La professeure Shimazu est donc la co-directrice de ce Tokyo College, avec lequel donc le Collège de France a signé une convention, et donc nous avons cet échange très intensif de professeurs et de jeunes chercheurs. Donc c'est vraiment un projet d'avenir. Mais aujourd'hui, donc après nous avoir parlé sous différents aspects de la guerre russo-japonaise de 1904-1905, aujourd'hui donc la professeure Shimazu va nous parler de cette conférence de la paix. Ça fait du bien d'entendre que ça existe quand même, de 1919. Et donc je lui laisse la parole sans plus.
Okay, thank you very much indeed to Professor Chang for hosting me and for allowing me to have this opportunity to present a series of four lectures on different aspects of modern Japanese history. And so, as you know, the title of the whole series is called War and Peace: A Global History of Japan from 1904 to 1943. So today we'll talk about peace. But before we talk about peace, we have to talk about war. So I'm going to give you a brief background on Japan during the First World War, what it did, before we go into the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. And I'm just going to give you, because as you, I'm sure you probably know, Paris Peace Conference of 1919 was one of the largest conferences on earth in human history. So it's not possible, obviously, to cover this in one lecture. So I'm going to just take parts of it so that I will, so that you see the context of Japan's participation at the Peace Conference. And then I'm going to actually talk a bit about the Americans at the Peace Conference because they were particularly interested in sort of exercising or practicing public diplomacy at the Peace Conference. And then we go into looking at the Japanese delegation and discuss, you know, what kind of people they had and the setup and so on in Paris. And then we talk about Japan's peace demands. What did it want from the peace conference? And then finally, some kind of assessment of the Japanese peace conference diplomacy. So what was Japan's contribution to the First World War, which merited its seat at the peace conference negotiating table? Mainstream historiography or studies of Japan during the First World War generally does not employ the framework of Japan at war to look at this period of Japanese history. Instead, this period is often characterized as the era of Taisho democracy or liberal democracy in Japanese politics and society. And even to this day, in Japanese thinking, there is still not very much awareness that Japan fought as one of the Allied powers in World War I. So during the war, the Japanese engaged in three main military expeditions. First, Japan declared war on Germany on the 23rd of August 1914 on the back of the Anglo-Japanese alliance, which was signed in 1902 between Japan and Britain. And this resulted in this joint expedition with the local British force to occupy the German concessions on the Shandong Peninsula in order to capture Qingdao, where the German East Asiatic Squadron was based, which was the largest concentration of German Navy outside of Europe. So it was a very important place in terms of German strategic thinking at the global level. Now, so in this battle, the Japanese mobilized nearly 52,000 troops, and Britain, which was the partner in this military expedition, mobilized 870 soldiers, so it's substantially less than the Japanese. And then there were troops, Indian troops, which also came in some sense as part of the British contingency, but there was 450 Indian troops. And so you, here you see this photograph. I don't know actually if you can see this. It's quite an interesting photograph because this is a photograph of the British troops. These are Brits coming in. And there is actually a Japanese officer standing here. And it's not very clear probably in this photograph, but if you kind of see a better version of the photograph, you can see the Japanese officers thinking, oh, these are the Brits, you know, who's coming to help us. So there is a very much an imbalance of the numbers of the Japanese troops vis-a-vis the British troops. And also, in some sense, it was primarily a Japanese military expedition. So this is Qingdao. And you see that it's very sort of a German town. And so when this city fell to the joint Japanese-British military operation, the local Germans who had been there, mostly from late, very late 19th century, and who actually were mobilized to fight for the German army based in that region, they became prisoners of war. And they were transported to Japan, to various camps during the First World War. And the most famous one is actually in this place called Bando on Shikoku Island. And this was sort of like a legendary POW camp, basically for good reasons, in that the Japanese, in some sense it's quite difficult to imagine this, but the Japanese experiences of dealing with POWs in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 5 and the First World War were seen to be exemplary examples of how to treat POWs. And particularly the Russo-Japanese War experience became sort of like the standard or applied internationally in terms of how to deal with POWs during wars. And so as you can imagine, this is actually a very little known aspect of the Japanese, earlier Japanese experiences of fighting international wars. Now, the second military expedition. So the outbreak of the war had set off a mini scramble for German territories in the Pacific. And New Zealand led the way by occupying Samoa by the 30th of August, followed by the Australian occupation of German New Guinea and the Solomon Islands by 15th of September. And hence the second, and then of course the Japanese occupied the, as you see, the Micronesian islands on this map in this area by the 14th of October. So on the surface, the Japanese conquest of the Micronesian islands may come across as a costly enterprise, which primarily helped to boost Japan's fragile ego at the newest great as the newest great power on the block, so to speak, or the group, a belated Japanese bid for the late 19th century Western imperial scramble for the Pacific. Nevertheless, from the geopolitical point of view, the success of this naval expedition could be considered as the most significant gain by Japan during the war, because it had helped to substantiate a geopolitical imagination of Japan's future as a significant Pacific power. Sorry. So you see the different regions, which were sort of kind of, let's say, spheres of influence of Australians, New Zealanders, and the Japanese in the Pacific, Central Pacific, and the South Pacific. Now we go to the third military expedition, which was the Siberian troop deployment of January 1918 as part of the Joint Allied Force expedition to fight against the Red Army forces after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. So this slide is an image of the Japanese troops marching in Vladivostok as part of the Allied forces. And as you can see, you see the flags of the Allied powers hanging down. Then these are the flags of the countries that deployed troops for the Siberian intervention. So in this intervention, Japan was asked to deploy 7,000 troops. And instead, it decided to contribute 73,000 troops. So this became a major problem, not surprisingly, particularly in Japan's relationship with the United States, whose distrust of the Japanese heightened substantially as a result of the Siberian troop deployment issue. And because the United States essentially had been opposing the Japanese troop deployment right from the beginning, and it was Britain, who was the alliance partner of Japan, who insisted that the Japanese should be allowed to deploy troops to Siberia. So geopolitically, United States was concerned that the Japanese troops might use this as a pretext to station troops in the region east of Lake Baikal. Moreover, the US government was concerned about the impact on American domestic opinion, which was already anti-Japanese due to the immigration crisis. So also internally in Japan, the cabinet was split between those who supported the larger deployment of 73,000 because it was an opportunity for Japan to expand into Siberia, and whilst the others actually vehemently opposed it because it was not seen to be worth the cost to aggravate American attitudes towards Japan. So this is a very interesting photograph. It's a Japanese postcard made out of a photograph of the troops standing next to each other. And then on the left, it says Britain, and then Canada, United States, China, Italy, the Czechs, and Japan. But if you, there are lots of different versions of this photo, postcard in circulation. And on some other postcards, basically the person who's put down here as a British soldier is named as an American soldier, and so on. So I think this version is probably not correct. But anyway, these are the kinds of postcards that had been in circulation at the time. Now, during the war, one of the really difficult things for the Japanese, it wasn't difficult for them in a way, because they saw the war as an opportunity. It was once in a lifetime opportunity for Japan to take advantage of the fact that the European powers are busily engaged in Europe, and so strike whilst the iron is hot in Asia. And particularly this pertained to the policy in China. And the Japanese attempted to increase power in China unilaterally. And there were two sort of major things that happened. The first one is called the 21 Demands of 1915, when there were five groups of demands had been laid out and presented to the Chinese government by the Japanese. And essentially, the fifth group of demand was the most controversial because it had basically demanded that the Chinese engage influential Japanese as political, financial, and military advisors. So in China, it was an outcry and a critical turning point And this really, really deteriorated the Sino-Japanese relationship during the war. And also, because China was a very close ally of the United States during the war, it aggravated Japan's relationship with the United States as well. So the Japanese at the time, most of the Japanese were very happy with this slogan of constitutionalism inside, i.e. inside Japan, respect for constitutionalism, and imperialism outside. Yes, we are going to be an expand, you know, take whatever opportunity you can in order to expand the Japanese empire. And then the second problem that emerged was the Nishihara loans of 1917 to 1918. So you can see that this came towards the end of the First World War. And these were eight separate loans made through an individual called Nishihara. And it was secretly underwritten by the Japanese government to support the Chuan-Chi Rui's Beiyang Army against rival warlords in China. And in exchange, the Chinese were to support Japan's claims at the forthcoming peace conference, whenever the war would end, was going to end, and support Japan's claims to the Shandong, German concessions in Shandong Peninsula, and additional rights in Manchuria. And this series of loans became extremely controversial in Japan, and it was essentially conducted without cabinet approval. So anyway, all this is going on and making everything very complex, and the United States enters war very late in April 1917. And this is followed by China in August 1917. And then, as I'm sure you know, the armistice came on the 11th of November 1918. So of course, these two countries are entering war very late in the game, because without being a belligerent, in the war, it's very difficult to get a seat at the peace conference table. So this is all about thinking, you know, strategizing ahead, thinking ahead of what is coming quite imminently. So within Japan, you start detecting different attitudes towards or different ministerial approaches to the First World War. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs actually thought that the First World War was primarily a European war. So as soon as they captured Qingdao, Shandong, in 1914, they effectively created a little section within the Foreign Ministry which said Japan-German peace section or something like this. So they were essentially thinking of this war as the one between Japan and Germany in East Asia. And of course, there was the Micronesian Islands that the Japanese captured early on, all in 1914. And so what Japan had to do was simply wait for the war to end. And it would go to a peace conference and demand for Shandong and the Micronesian Islands. Now, the Ministry of Army and also Ministry of Navy, they had a very different attitude, which is that before 1914, Germany was the most important military partner or ally for the army. And in terms of the fact that there had been lots of exchanges of German military officers coming to Japan and also contributing to teaching at military academies in Japan. And so there was quite a large input of German kind of military thinking in Japanese army, and also a lot of kind of relationships between officers and so on. But as I said, in this occasion, on the First World War, Japan was on the other side. Japan was not on the side of Germany. So they couldn't go to Germany during the war. And so instead, they had to obviously stop the relationship with Germany. And the Japanese actually ended up sending quite a lot of military observers to the Allied countries, basically, obviously, for cooperation purposes, but also they conducted lots of very interesting, important research. And so in total, the Japanese army sent, I mean, I have a number here which is very precise, 187 military observers to Allied powers during the First World War. And believe it or not, out of 187, 56 came to France. So France was the top country to which military observers were sent. And then Britain was the second, was 51, Russia, 33, United States, 27, and Italy, 20. So Japan, if you can imagine Japan in that period, Japan was quite integrated into the transnational society of military attachés and observers. And these people have their own code of conduct and friendships and respect were formed between them. So you can sort of imagine Japan as being quite an international kind of cosmopolitan player at this time in the early part of the 20th century. Now, these observers, as I said, conducted important army studies, and especially on total war mobilization on the home front, and, you know, taking lessons from the United Kingdom, the United States, and so on, because they couldn't really go to Germany during the war. Okay, so what do we think about Japan's participation in the First World War? So, as you saw, the military participation was limited, mainly because of the limited conception of Japan's role in the war, especially on the behalf of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as I explained. Secondly, Japanese wartime actions in China and Siberia undoubtedly worsened Japan's relationship with the United States, especially a strong sense of distrust grew in the U.S. State Department. Of course, Japanese had relationship with the U.K. as well, because it was an alliance partner. And the British were actually, in some sense, more understanding of Japan's need to expand its empire in a funny way. And so it was actually the United States that that became very distrustful of the Japanese. Now, the Japanese diplomatic decision-making during this period had been taken away, really, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to a transcendental body, which did not report to the cabinet, which reported directly to the emperor. And this was called the Diplomatic Advisory Council, which operated from June 1917 to September 2022. And this had a substantial impact on the way foreign affairs or foreign policy decisions were being taken in Japan. And then one more thing to bear in mind is that the Japanese had a realpolitik understanding of wartime politics. And because it was an alliance partner of the largest navy in the world, Britain, it felt quite secure that its rewards at the peace conference, i.e. the Shandong settlement and the Micronesian settlements, would be given over to the Japanese. And also, in this time, they were beginning to feel that their position, they were definitely the major regional power in East Asia through the war, although they were actually sort of situated in a complex web of great power imperial rivalry that was going on in East Asia. So now we go to the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. We set the scene. So many of the decisions taken at the Paris Peace Conference were to have a lasting impact on various aspects of 20th century history. And possibly the most successful idea to emerge from the conference was the principle of self-determination, advocated by the United States President Woodrow Wilson. However, the whole peace process was complicated by the fact that underneath the surface of new diplomacy, as propounded mainly by Woodrow Wilson, There lay the methods and interests of the old diplomacy, exercised fully by the other great powers. So you can see that the world was very much in a state of flux. As not only was the old European status quo being threatened by the American new diplomacy, but both Europeans and Americans felt threatened by the rise of revolutionary socialism in the Soviet Union. So anyway, the peace conference started on the 18th of January 1919, and the Treaty of Versailles, as some of you may know, was signed on the 20th of June 1919. But of course, this was only one of the treaties. There are lots of different treaties signed as a result of the conference, peace conference. And some people basically say that peace conference actually continued on to early 1920. And 32 countries attended the Paris Peace Conference. And it was a massive, massive conference structure which was set up. And if you can imagine, the key people in many of these countries actually spent probably up to 6 months at least in Paris. So the cabinets and, you know, the government sort of moved, bureaucracies moved to Paris from these countries. And even the top leaders like Wilson, they would spend months at a time in Paris. So we're talking about a very different kind of environment of how peace conferences were held. And today, you know that summits are only 1.5 days, 2 days, 3 days. And that's quite long, you know. But in those days, top leaders spent weeks and weeks, and then they go back home and check the domestic situation, and they would come back again. And of course, things happen in their absence, so they don't actually want to be away from the domestic politics, but also from the Paris politics that's going on. So it wasn't easy being leaders at the time. So it was chaired by the French president, Premier Georges Clemenceau, and attended by, as you know, Woodrow Wilson, David Lloyd George from the United States, and Vittorio Orlando from Italy. And so the key decision-making body at the for the first few months was called the Council of Ten. And then later it became the Council of Four. And it only included US, Britain, France, and Italy. And they were also known as the Big Four. And then, you know, as I spoke about the different ideologies, I'll just go to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, which were announced in January 1918, which became a very important kind of like a blueprint in some sense at the peace conference. And as I said, principle of self-determination became an important international principle of justice, particularly in the later parts of the 20th century with decolonization in the post-45 period. And then one of the biggest tasks that the peace conference had was to create a new international order. So previously it was based on the balance of power idea, and now they were going to have an institution called the League of Nations, which was going to sort of like, you know, manage international conflicts, settlements, and all this. Right, so the thing about one of the most important characteristics of the Paris Peace Conference, which marked it out from previous peace conferences, such as the Congress of Vienna, was that it was predominantly a gathering of the top elected representatives of the newly emerging liberal democracies or liberal or democratic world. At least that's how they saw themselves. And in Woodrow Wilson's very words, Vienna was a congress of bosses, whereas Versailles must be a meeting of the servants of peoples represented by the delegates. So by 1919, all the great powers, apart from Japan, had universal male suffrage, first being France in 1792, reenacted in 1848, followed by the United States in 1869, Britain and France 1918, and Japan in 1925. So added to the fact that the First World War had mobilized so many people and resulted in such an enormous number of casualties, a sense of crisis pervaded in many Western societies, and this was aggravated by the threat of communism as a result of the Bolshevik Revolution. So in that sense, the First World War was a paradigm-shifting experience insofar as political accountability was concerned, as popular expectations placed on political leaders were much greater than at any other time before this period, and greater media scrutiny of their political leaders in 1919 was a reflection of the changing nature of the relationship between the political elite and the ever-expanding electoral body. So all the statesmen at Paris were therefore to varying degrees performing for the benefit of their domestic audience back home. So in lieu of monarchical pageantry, the public became interested in a new diplomatic pageantry of the grandest kind as it unfolded at Paris and climaxed symbolically in the Hall of Mirrors of the Palace of Versailles, now filled with politicians and bureaucrats who were the new royalties in the age of popular democracy. Now, so the Americans were the big experts at this public diplomacy at the peace conference. They were aware of the symbolic importance of their representation, and which were evident in many details about details of the American presence at the peace conference. So the Americans wrote about their entry to Paris as though they were liberating Europe. And American mission to negotiate peace had over 1,000 staff working in their office. And they were based at Hotel Crillon. And so they centered themselves in the center of Paris, representing sort of their national power, so to speak. And then the mansion of Prince Murat, Wilson's temporary home, became known as the Paris White House. And Wilson was sort of written about as the savior of Europe. Now, the Italian foreign minister at the time, Francesco Severino Nitti, later wrote of Nielsen, "I have seen Wilson come to Europe in 1918, acclaimed as the apostle of the new civilization and the liberator of the peoples." Now, all this excitement about Paris, the New York Times journalist wrote in December 1918, "It is far worse than when the Tsar of Russia visited Paris. You would think every Parisian had determined not to rest happy until he had a close personal view of President Wilson." The speaker was a veteran gendarme attached to the force guarding the entrances of Rue du Monceau, where Prince Murat's house is situated, from the over-curious crowds. Somehow the news had spread yesterday that the president had been to church and would return at about noon. The result was an enthusiastic gathering before the police barriers. Hundreds of people, quiet and well-behaved, in their Sunday clothes, but resolved not to leave the spot before the president had passed. Suddenly the boy on the outskirts of the crowd cried, "Le voilà," as a limousine turned the corner. Hats came off, flags and handkerchiefs were waved, and the air rang with shouts of "Vive Wilson, vive le président." And this is one of the photographs on Rue Royale in Paris, obviously. And I don't, you probably can't see it as well, but there is Maxime's here in the corner this year. And you have this sign over it. And there are different versions of this photograph, but this is one of them. So, welcome the age of public diplomacy. The role of media in the new age of public diplomacy was of paramount importance. Creation of state news agencies, good relations with commercial presses became very important for foreign ministries and politicians. And the United States again led on this game of public diplomacy as they created what's called the Committee on Public Information, called CPI, in April 1917 for the forthcoming peace conference after the First World War. And George Creel was the man who was successful in, let's say, packaging Wilson to be used for the CPI's propaganda activities. Now, Wilson himself had his own press secretary at the peace conference, somebody called Ray Stannard Baker. And if you look at the daily goings on of Wilson, you will see how often he spoke to Ray Stannard Baker. And then, so visual images of Wilson were in press photographs and newsreels distributed globally, and often became the key reference point of the event for the public at large. So the power of images sort of worked as substitutes for reality. Now, of course, if you get overexposure like this, it can actually result in overexpectations. And this meant that Wilson's downfall was so much greater when he failed to deliver the goods at the peace conference, particularly on national self-determination, which included Shandong to the colonized world and so on. Now, you may be thinking, when is she going to talk about Japan? So here it is. So Japan attended this conference as one of the five great powers and the only non-Western great power. So this was a culmination of a half a century of intensive national effort to create a modern state since the Meiji Restoration of 1868. And in retrospect, the presence of Japan in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, signing the Treaty of Versailles on the 28th of June, 1919, was a truly astonishing feat. Only 50 years before, it would have been impossible to imagine Japan that we see in 1919. So in principle, Japan was a paragon of success, proud and content with its newly acquired position of great eminence. Although Japan's rise may appear to have been successfully and effortlessly carried out, there inevitably existed internal and external tensions surrounding its emergence as a great power. So the Paris Peace Conference of 1919 showed the world of 1919, and it was still dominated by Western imperial powers, and Japan's position within it was unique. So in this sense, Japan's participation was highly significant because it was the only power in the non-Western world which could possibly make any impact on the conference and the world thereafter. Now, the Japanese delegation obviously selected its five delegates because each delegation were allowed to select five plenipotentiaries. And first of all, it consisted of Prince Saionji Kinmochi, who was the chief plenipotentiary. He was a very senior, what's called elder statesman, genro in Japanese politics. And he was not the actual prime minister at the time, he was an old acquaintance of Clemenceau when Saionji was studying in Paris as a student. And so Saionji arrives in Marseille, from Japan on the boat, and he arrives late. He arrives, I think, sort of like February or something, and the peace conference started in January. And there's a photo of him. I tried to find it again. I'm sorry, I couldn't find it, but photo of him with a mistress arriving together in Marseille. And so this is a real problem, as you can see, when Wilson, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, so everybody's working very hard every day, and there's this Japanese leader who is supposed to be the fifth great power. He arrives in a leisurely manner, almost like a holiday to France, you know. And from the and of course he was ill because he was, you know, he had some illness. Now, as far as the Japanese were concerned, he was an ideal choice because he was a patrician liberal figure, you know, very well respected in Japanese politics. And also, he strongly believed that Japan could not survive in isolation from the West. So it was important to send somebody as the head of the delegation who believed in cooperation with the West, because not everybody was like that back in Japan. Now, the number two was this man called, he was a baron, Makino Nobuaki. And he was the, actually, maybe you might want to look at the photos here. Sorry, it's a tiny photo. And Sion-ji, I'll bring this. So let me see where Sion-ji is. So Sion-ji is this guy here. He's the chief. And Makino is this guy here. So he was basically de facto the chief, potentially, because Sion-ji wasn't really working. And so Makino had to do all the day-to-day negotiations, and he actually was a proper diplomat, so to speak. He had postings in Vienna and so on. And also he was the former foreign minister of Japan. But he was a very cautious individual and also very bureaucratic. Now, Chinda Stemi, who is not on this photograph, unfortunately, he was an ambassador to London. And he had sort of famously short temper. So you often see extra excerpts of Chinda being angry about something. But he's not on this photograph. And then there was Matsui Keishiro, who is, where is he? Oh, yes, it's this guy here. So he was the Japanese ambassador to Paris. And the last one is the Japanese ambassador to Rome, called Ijuin. Hikokichi, this one here. So he came up from Rome. So as you can see, the Japanese basically gathered high-ranking Japanese diplomats from Europe in order to come and make this Japanese delegation. And also, they were seriously short of people. So they... Sorry, the delegation had 64 people, but in general, they did not have enough people who spoke English because it was held in France, so they could get people who spoke French, but they couldn't really find enough people speaking in English, and everything was done in basically in English. So that became quite a problem for the Japanese delegation. And the Prime Minister of Japan, called Hara at the time, he actually thought this was a good selection because they were all pro-Western people and they all knew the West very well. And they had no conception that the Prime Minister should come to this conference. And the Foreign Minister was also busy in Japan. Those two people were far too busy to come to this conference, peace conference. And Chinda, who was the ambassador in London, when he sort of found out that Wilson was coming, and David Lloyd George was going, he sent a telegraph to Japan saying, look, these people are coming, so we have to have at least the Prime Minister here. And the Japanese said, well, no, he's very busy at home, so he cannot be spared. So this has a serious impact on the Japanese bargaining position at Paris, because they simply cannot bargain in the same way that other leaders could. And therefore, it impacts Japan's sort of performance overall. And this might also be interesting for you, because this is actually about the seating plan of the Council of Ten. And so the Japanese are seated right here, from here, down here. And who are seated here? These are the British Empire delegation had the British Dominion representatives. So they were seated as part of the British Empire, and so before the Japanese delegation. Well, so the Japanese, you see, so Japanese seating, they were also placed opposite China. And of course, they were having problems over Shandong with China. So it's very complicated, this issue, because I'm sure they all thought about it very hard, how they're going to place all these people. But Japanese felt really dissatisfied about where they were sat, you know, where they were seated in this conference, and generally kind of was thought to reflect badly on Japan. Okay. Now, what were the Japanese peace demands? So, as I said, Japan was given the fifth rank as a great power after US, Britain, France, and Italy. So within this group of great powers, there was a definitive hierarchy. And that's actually quite important to remember. So it's not everybody's equal within this group, which is already incredibly select and elitist. And if you were a great power, then you had to be a power with general interests. And in a way, Japan wasn't, actually. Japan had specific interests, right? If you remember back to the peace terms. So Japan, you could also argue, was kind of over-promoted, you know, at the peace conference. But it nevertheless sat there as one of the five great powers. So it actually asked for the first rights, as you probably know by now, is the former German rights in the Micronesian Islands. And the Japanese felt very secure about this demand because there had been a series of secret agreements signed between the key powers like France, UK, and Italy. And United States was not part of this. So when this became clear, the United States raised quite a big hustle because they said, well, we can't accept this. But then all the other powers sort of quietly said, well, we signed this agreement, we all accept this, because there was this, you know, quid pro quo exchange going on behind the scenes. Now, the second one was the former German concessions on the Shandong Peninsula, which became very problematic, and I explain later. And then the third demand was this thing called the racial equality proposal, which was a demand for a racial equality clause to be inserted into the covenant of the League of Nations, and it was drafted in the League of Nations Commission. Now, the outcome of the negotiations was that, yes, Japan was given a Class C mandate over the Micronesian Islands, so effectively became under Japanese control during the interwar period. And so through this, the Japanese presence in Central Pacific became a semi-permanent geopolitical reality. Now, this is very significant because of the Japanese naval expansion southward was felt most keenly by Australia and New Zealand. So if you remember back to the earlier slides where you had Australia and New Zealand occupying the German islands in the South Pacific and the Japanese come last occupy the Micronesian islands, they have a very keen sense of threat from Japan. Now, the second point is that the Shandong settlement was ruled in favor of Japan. And of course, this sort of has serious implications in China as well, because it ignited the May 4th movement in 1919. And eventually, Shandong gets returned to China in 1922. So this thing about Japanese wartime occupations or, you know, maneuverings in China seemed to the Japanese to be a good thing to do, to take opportunity of the situation. But in the end, it backfired quite a lot at the peace conference because of this thing that I mentioned before of aggravating the relationship with the United States in particular and China. And so the Japanese were very surprised about the problems he had over the Shandong settlements, because the Japanese had assumed that they were going to get this, and so on. But it obviously didn't. They had to fight quite hard, they thought, in order to get the Shandong settlement after all. And then lastly, the racial equality proposal was rejected. Those of you who know me know that I wrote a whole PhD dissertation on this topic of why the racial equality proposal was raised and rejected. But I'm not going to tell the whole story, but a very short version of why it was important. So why was the Japanese keen on this thing called the racial equality proposal? In December 1918, this is like about the time when the plenipotentiaries like Makino is about to set off. He's arriving near Yokohama, you know, port, and about to board the ship. And the day before, he gets told that actually, you know, what are you going to do about this thing called the League of Nations? You know, isn't Wilson talking about it? And yes, of course, it's going to be discussed because that was part of the premise of the peace conference being convened. But the Japanese didn't understand this. So they said, look, look, if this thing called the League of Nations is going to be created, we have to make sure that we don't get racially discriminated in this new international organization. So make sure that you come up with something that's going to prevent the racial discrimination of us from happening in this new international organization. So when the Paris Peace Conference begins, the Japanese delegates realize for the first time that, oh my God, this thing is really going to happen. We have to activate this instruction from the Diplomatic Advisory Council about the League of Nations. And so they quickly start thinking about what to do. And this starts around the 22nd of January. And this negotiation was the most intense out of all the peace conference demands for the Japanese at the peace conference. And it went on until the 28th of April, 1919. And there are almost daily records of meetings of Japanese delegates going between, you know, Arthur Balfour of the British delegation, and then goes to talk to Edmund House, who was the special advisor to Woodrow Wilson. And then they get told to go and talk to somebody else, and then so on. So this thing is going on very intensely for the Japanese throughout this entire 3 months. And so at the League of Nations Commission, senior plenipotentiaries, Makino and Chinda, they proposed to insert a racial equality clause, as I said, into the covenant. And this went through so many different drafts, and mostly was redrafted by the American legal team at the peace conference. And anyway, one of the biggest opposition came from the Australian Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, because he was the big proponent of the White Australia policy. And he said, absolutely no, not over my dead body. So anyway, this became an incredibly difficult negotiation for all sides concerned. And one of the main reasons was that the racial equality proposal was interpreted by some parts of the US delegation and the British dominions within the British Empire delegation as relating to immigration. So they said, if we have this clause in the covenant of the League of Nations, we are effectively allowing free immigration into Australia, New Zealand, United States, and so on. And they didn't want this. And so this is why it became such a big issue. Now, ultimately, this gets ruled in the League of Nations Commission, and it's defeated. And the reason why it's defeated, there was a majority in favor of accepting this clause, but it was defeated because Woodrow Wilson at that point imposed unanimity ruling. And that was quite rare, actually, in the League of Nations Commission discussions. And why did he do that? Because he wanted to save the League of Nations from, you know, getting rejected by the British, because the British were basically the thing about the British Empire delegation. It's very difficult to explain this, but you have the British government, right? David Lloyd George, Arthur Balfour, and then you have the British Dominion governments. So the British government on certain issues, like this issue, felt that they could not override the British Empire delegations, British dominions. Whereas on other issues, it was much more closer to this kind of, let's say, metropole imperial concerns, so they were able to make decisions without having dominions. So on this issue, they simply, British Empire said, a delegation, dominion said, we cannot support this issue. So as a result, they could not support, if they could not support the racial equality proposal, then Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, became very worried that the whole, you know, thing about the League of Nations was simply going to collapse. And that was the whole reason why he came to Paris, to create the League of Nations. Anyway, so what's very important to remember is that racial politics played a significant part in some of these kind of political military calculations made by the Allied powers, particularly by the United States. Now, just to complicate things a little bit, if I'm allowed to do this in a few minutes, is that the racial equality proposal, the rejection of it, had a direct impact on the Shandong settlement ruling. And these things take place in very sort of close sequence to one another chronologically during the peace conference. And the reason is that the United States President Wilson felt very guilty about having said no to the Japanese racial equality proposal. And most of the Japanese US delegation was actually against giving Shandong in favor of Japan. And they thought it should be returned to China. And so President Wilson thought that if he did that, if he allowed that to happen, Japan would be denied twice, right, racial equality and Shandong. So he felt that it was very important that Japan should not be felt, should not feel that it was not going to be given anything very much apart from the Micronesian islands. So he made this, in some sense, extremely realpolitik calculations in his mind. And he was opposed by a number of people within his delegation. But Wilson's decision-making manner or decision-making approach was very hierarchical. So he simply ignored other delegates' opinions. And he decided this, and he made this decision. Okay, so what happened subsequently was that in late March 1919, the Council of Ten is reformed, and the decision making becomes even narrowed down to just the four countries, and this excludes Japan. So Japan from late 1919 is no longer, in some sense, a great power at the peace conference, and this causes a kind of huge problem back in Japan, because it seemed to be a demotion at the peace conference. And what I actually want to show you is this photograph, right? Because one of the things that I kind of have been working on recently is this idea of kind of political diplomatic culture of sociability. And the Big Four here is an exclusive form of decision making, and it's sort of European Western based social cultural sociability of the political elite. In which the environment in which the Japanese felt very uncomfortable having to be one of them here. Now, if you know anything about these people, so you have David Lloyd George, and then you got Orlando, kind of, you know, going like this to David Lloyd George, and then you got Clemenceau, and you got Wilson. So Orlando, the one who's going like this, he could not speak English. And David Lloyd George, to whom he's going like this, could not speak French. So I don't know what he's doing. And then only Clemenceau could speak both French and English. So even in this very exclusive Big Four, you see the communication issues at hand. And it becomes really important because it's such a small group. And they didn't want interpreters in. And so that created its own set of problems. Let's move on, because I think we are definitely running out of time. So Well, I think I went too fast. Sorry. Okay, so there were sort of structural weaknesses to the Japanese delegation. And basically the general lack of awareness, general lack of preparedness, and, you know, the outside world thought that the Japanese plenipotentiaries were not very impressive. And the most one of the most important problems was actually the decision-making structure on foreign policy, because the Paris plenipotentiaries could not decide anything without getting approval from Tokyo. And I've seen every single document in this period on the Japanese foreign ministry, and they only wrote telegraph once every 2 weeks. And I'm just thinking, no, but this afternoon they're going to talk about this. So they could not say anything. So often the Japanese plenipotentiaries just sat, and they could not nod. They could not go like this. And so they were known as the Sphinx, you know, the Egyptian Sphinx, because they were so silent. And they were known as the silent partners in the peace conference. So of course, you know, the Japanese audience is looking at all this, and they think the foreign ministry is hopeless. We can't. We basically, you know, the army thinks there's a serious problem with the foreign ministry. We can't trust them to make foreign affair policy decisions because it's so important to Japan. The Navy also thinks quite similarly, though not as harsh as the army. And then within the foreign ministry itself, the younger diplomats, bureaucrats who were there witness all this in front of their eyes, and they become very disillusioned by the state of things in their ministry. So they form a society of reformists who were basically full of these junior bureaucrats, and a lot of them were in that photograph that you saw. So one of them, just to say, the Japanese, very famous Japanese man called Goto Shinpei, who was governor of Taiwan, he was working for the colonial Taiwan and, you know, involved in lots of very important sort of infrastructural projects in Japan and was a politician and so on. He said, Japan, though ranking among the five great powers, unfortunately compared but poorly with them in actual fact. He considered that both at the Peace Paris Conference and elsewhere, Japanese journalists, scholars, politicians, and officials all failed to reach the average level of capacity. And another right, this is a very ultra-nationalist thinker, says, the Japanese people ought to die of shame in the face of the fact that they sent to the peace conference such ineffective and disgraceful representatives. So, this is the last slide. So, what do we do? Perception of the racial equality proposal within Japan as being a symbolic one meant that its defeat was also seen as being a symbolic defeat. And so the public opinion in Japan thought that the West was not willing to accept racial equality as an international principle of justice. So the blame was placed on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So the big question is, who should be in charge of Japanese foreign policy? So that's it. Thank you.
Collège de France. Le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.